Tonight's reading is from the first chapter of the book of Ruth. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Naomi's husband died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." The word of the Lord.
It is very possible that a not inconsequential number of German parents ate their children in the Middle Ages. I mean, there's not a lot of hard evidence, but there is, I think, enough literary critical evidence, or indicators anyway, that suggest that a high probability of German parents ate their children in the Middle Ages. Okay, maybe it's not a high probability. Maybe it seems probable if you're high. I don't know. But just look. If you just, okay, do you know how many fairy tales are all about covering up some really heinous parenting? I mean, really, you know, how many of these stories also, these fairy tales, these stories, they're about famine. So many of them are at their core about hunger. And I think maybe if you are starving and you're desperate, I mean, a person could do a lot of desperate things. If you're starving and desperate and your kids are starving and you can't bear to see them suffering, you might think, this is a way to kill two birds with one stone. Oh, only they're not birds. You know, in Western Europe, in the Middle Ages, life was hard. I mean, life was really hard. You know, I thought the dead children stuff would come off funnier. But in Western Europe, in the Middle Ages, life was really hard. I mean, there were plagues, and not just the famous ones, all kinds of them. And there was famine. There was food shortages, and there was just like wars all the time. And for the average person, which meant peasant, it was just like subsistence living. Like, okay, think of the most famous famine-inspired tale there is, right? Hansel and Gretel. I know you're saying to yourselves, hey, wait a minute, that's not a fairy tale about German parents eating their children. That's a fairy tale about a wicked stepmother manipulating her weak-willed schlub of a husband to abandon his kids in the woods, and a wicked witch finding them and fattening them up for her to eat them, and then them escaping and the father showing up just in time to bring them home and explain that he's no longer with Carol, their former stepmother, and he's vowing now to be more emotionally present for them. And you're right. You're right. That's how the story ends up. But it started out very different. The very oldest versions of the story are just horrific. There's a famine, and this whole family's going to die. The whole family's going to die of starvation, and the mom and dad no longer have any food to feed Hansel and Gretel. It's been a long time since they did. And the children are crying because they're so hungry, and the parents realize that the kids will not even make it a few more days. So they decide to save them from suffering until the inevitable happens, and so they put them out of their misery. And then once they do it, it occurs to them that they should not let the deaths of their children be in vain. And so to not let their deaths mean nothing, they eat them. And there are versions of this story that go into the most grotesque details about how they kill them, and even more grotesque about how they prepare them and eat them. This is like horror stuff. Because you see, the part of the purpose of these stories, these tales, these narratives, is to make them as horrific as possible so that it goes way beyond what any kind of horrible thing that the storytellers and the heroes actually had to do to their children when they were starving. It was like cathartic. It was a communal way of dealing with this just unspeakable tragedy that just naturally occur when you're living that close to the ground. But as the famine and the suffering got further in the past, the stories, even to them, seemed like just too much. And they could barely conceive of such awfulness. So they started to change these tales, these narratives. They're like, come on, the parents were never going to eat the children. They aren't monsters. And they would never kill their children. No circumstances could be that bad. So maybe the parents in the story could, maybe no longer feed their children, have enough to feed their children, so they abandon them in the woods, where a hunter might find them maybe and feed them, but instead this evil witch catches them and fattens them up to eat them, and then it's the wicked witch that eats them, not the parents. But then even those stories, with all their detailed description of how this horrible witch caught them and butchered the children and ate them, even those stories got to seem too much, because as time went on and Europe became even more civilized, they just seemed over the top. I mean, it really couldn't end up. We can't tell this story to each other about how our children get murdered and eaten, so maybe the children get away in the end. Yeah. And then later, it wouldn't do to have their own mother and father abandon them in the woods. What horrible people would do something like that? So what if the mom died because she had secretly been not eating any of the food so she could give her children more? And then the dad married a new wife so the children would have a mother. But she turns out to be a horrible, horrible, evil woman. So evil that the husband was no match for her, and she twisted his mind, convincing him to bring the children out into the woods and abandon them. Oh, and while you're at it, have the witch's house made out of candy so the kids are attracted to it because they love candy, and that way it's kind of a little bit their fault for eating sugar when they know they shouldn't. So if the evil stepmother would have never manipulated the father, and the kids would never have strayed away, and the kids would have stayed away from sweets like they're supposed to, and the evil child-eating witch wouldn't have been so evil and, like child-eating, then none of this would have happened. But luckily, the father saw the evil stepmother for what she was, kicked her to the curb, and ran to rescue his beloved children, and everybody lived happily ever after. Well, mostly the father did. Mostly the father did, because it's pretty clear who's doing the rewriting to these stories here. The men, clearly. Where are all the evil stepfathers in these stories? They don't seem to show up. So the point is not just that narratives change over time as cultures change, but that narratives change to benefit the teller. And the stories that survive, that are eventually preserved, written down, published, are the stories that are told by the people in power. And guess what? A staggering number of the people in power, and an astonishing amount of across an astonishing amount of cultures, and over a shocking portion of history, they're all men. And when you follow a changing narrative over time, we see that a narrative not only shifts to favor the powerful, but you also see that the binary oppositions in the stories are increasingly featured in these narratives. There's a good character and a bad character, and that's just cranked up to 11. Increasingly, the characters that best represent the people in power, that character is increasingly depicted as righteous, innocent, good. And the characters that are least like the people in power are moved into oppositional relationships. They are depicted as morally flawed, guilty, bad. But not all of them. Not in all cultures, not in all time. Not all of these folk narratives reflect the dominance of powerful men. There are versions of Hansel and Gretel type stories, these narratives in many cultures. And there's one from Southeast Asia where the parents, because they're starving, bring their children into the jungle and abandon them, hoping for the best. But they later come to their senses and they go back to find them, because they're so sorrowful that they did this. And so they rush back to find them. But in the meantime, monkeys had discovered the abandoned children. And they feed the children and they take care of the children. And they teach the children how to live in the jungle like monkeys. And so when they come back, the parents come back to find the children that they so horribly and shamefully have left in the jungle, they can't find them anywhere. And they look for so long that they're hungry and they passed out from exhaustion and hunger. Well, the monkeys and the children come down from the trees and they feed the parents and revive them. And at first the parents don't even recognize that this is their children, because they have begun actually to change to look more like monkeys, to look more like the ones that cared for them and took care of them and fed them. But when the parents do recognize that this is their children, they are so elated. They're so elated, and they just say, now you can come home. The famine is over. You can come back and live at home. But the children say, this is our home. They say, this is who we are now. And the parents have to go back to their home, sad, without their children. Now that is a very different narrative, told from a very different point of view, with a very different comment on power. In the German story, and this European story, the power clearly shifts to the man. He's practically innocent in this whole thing. It's these evil women trying to get him to abandon his kid or eat them that are in trouble. It's the women who are bad, clearly. Yeah, the evil warlock, I don't know, doesn't have quite the ring as evil witch, because that's what's handed down to us. So the power shifts in these stories and these binary oppositions are increased. There's the good people and the bad people, and there's not much gray area. But in this story from Southeast Asia, it doesn't really happen like that. The parents go out into the jungle. A group of monkeys are the ones who kind of like nurture these children. And while the parents couldn't feed the children, it ends up that the children feed the parents. And the parents came back because they loved their children, and they were starving too, so they weren't thinking right. So they come back, but in the end, because this has actually happened and they have changed, they aren't able to be together. It's hard to find the good people and the bad people in that story. It just doesn't work like that. There's not that kind of binary opposition. There's not that interest to control the narratives to favor those in power. The story of Ruth that we read at the beginning of today is a famine tale. It starts out because in Israel there's a famine. So this man, whose name I can't remember and isn't very easy to pronounce, takes his wife, which is Naomi, much easier to pronounce, and much more memorable. And you don't remember this guy very much because as soon as they go to this country, Moab, where there's food. So they go there, and the father dies. They have two kids, and then the father dies. That's why he's not very memorable. They have two sons, and the two sons grow up, and they marry Moabite women. And then they grow, and Naomi and her two sons and her two daughter-in-laws are living fine. But then the sons die. So now it's just Naomi and her two daughters-in-law. Ruth, which is a name you all know, remember, maybe even have yourself, and Orpah, which you don't hear that much. I know it sounds like Oprah for a dyslexic, but she actually was named Orpah and changed it later. Named after this character, which is a crazy character to name your child after in this story, because what happens is Orpah and Naomi, who are living there, Ruth, who are living with their mother-in-law, Naomi. Naomi hears that the famine's over, so they decide to go back to Israel. And as they're beginning to travel and they're traveling back, Naomi stops and says, "Look, you are not Israelites. You are Moabites. Your people are all back there. You could live a great life back there. You could get new husbands now. My husband said, you've been so great to take care of me all this time, even though you're not my flesh and blood, but you've been so fantastic. And you don't have to go with me back to Israel. You can go back. And thank you, and I give you my blessing, and turn back my daughters and go and have husbands, because I'm old and I'm not going to have any more sons, and you can't even wait. You'll be old by the time they're old enough to marry, so have a great life. Go back there." But the daughter-in-law say, "No, we pledge ourselves to you. We want to take care of you. You know, we love you." And she says, "No, go back, go back." So Orpah receives her blessing from her mother-in-law and returns to her people. But Ruth says, "No, never, never. I will." She clings to her. She stays with her, and she goes on with her mother Naomi back to Israel. And she ends up meeting a guy. It's a whole story. It's only like two more chapters. You can read it later. Ruth marries this guy Boaz, and they take care of Naomi. And lo and behold, they become the parents of, in the line of David. David, just three generations later, comes from this great union. And it's the union of this woman from Israel and this Moabite from a completely different country. And the greatest man of Israel, the king, David, comes from that union. So Ruth is celebrated everywhere because of this story. She gives birth to the greatest person who, you know, also then goes on to be in the New Testament, the lineage. We trace that lineage down to Jesus. And Ruth is even mentioned in the lineage in Matthew of Jesus. So where's Orpah? Orpah is only mentioned two times. And it's in this story at the beginning there. She's once, I think, in verse 4, and 1 and 14, and then she's done. But her story is not written down. She doesn't disappear. Her story, it does not produce a king. Her story is not part one that is told by those in power. So her story doesn't get preserved, but she has a story. Now, in the Midrash, and which is all that, well, it's almost like this oral it's this oral tradition that doesn't get written down. There's a lot of extra tales about Orpah and what becomes of her. And I mean, it's not good. It says that in the same way that Ruth is lionized, Orpah, because she turned back, is villainized. It says that that night, this is what that rabbis tell these stories, that night when she turned away, that night she had sex with 100 men and a dog. I mean, that is villainous. And because of this, her just insane, incalculable appetite, she gave birth to these four giant warriors, one of which was Goliath. And they went and they fought and oppressed Israel. And they were always going there in battle because they were, and nobody could defeat them until who comes along? This little shepherd boy, David. And he comes and he slays Goliath, Orpah's son. And then the army of the Israelites goes on to slay the other three sons. But when she's finally losing her last son, Orpah tries to intervene, and the head of the Israel army kills Orpah. Nothing good about her. She did nothing good. She's the bad sister. Ruth's the good sister. She remained a foreigner, while Ruth came to love the one true God. When you read the evangelical interpretations of this text, which I always like to read that because those are my people where I come from, and often it's funny. This says that what happened to Orpah was, the story goes, Ruth was bringing them both back to Israel. Naomi was bringing them both back to Israel. And she said to Ruth and she said to Orpah, now, when we go back, you guys are foreigners. And our people are not going to like foreigners. Unless, of course, you convert to faith in the one true God. And so Ruth, all for it. She accepts Jesus as her personal Lord and Savior. But Orpah's not having it. She goes back. And because she was the bad sister, she is the one that she affected her line even backwards. This is why their husbands and the sisters died, because they knew that this eventually was going to happen and she was going to create this Goliath guy and evil all around. Narratives are always changing. Narratives are always changing. It's how they continue to be meaningful to us over time. Small stories that we tell ourselves, you know, having to do with, you know, I don't know, David Bowie and Mick Jagger. Larger stories having to do with America, maybe even our faith. So narratives are always changing. That's how we continue to find meaning in them. And how they continue to be meaningful over time. But when narratives begin to shift to benefit the powerful, and binary oppositions begin to dominate the narratives, it's time to read these narratives with suspicion. We don't have to accept the narratives that are handed to us in the form that they are given. And we can embrace narratives that instead widen the circle. Narratives that are not concerned with gathering power, but with distributing it. Narratives where the powerful don't always get there on the backs of the small. Narratives that understand the nuance that good and evil, there's a lot of room in between. We have this sort of, I don't know what, it's this narrative. It's incredible. It's a narrative where God comes to earth and is labeled a sinner, is arrested and executed, and instead of God storming back to prove who has the real power and who the real bad guys are, this God allows God's creation to murder him and then returns and uses that act as a sign of grace, as a sign of love, as a sign of mercy. The stories we tell each other, the stories we tell ourselves, the stories that we live out always have the possibility for redemption.